So we're on the last lap of our having a look at the book of Numbers. We start with chapter 25. While Israel was staying at Shittim, the people began to have sexual relations with the women of Moab. Trouble starting. These invited the people to sacrifices of their gods. So they're putting back, see, this is the problem with, you know, in they're thinking of the purity of their faith and religion. These invited the people to sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. Thus, Israel yoked itself to the Baal of Peor, and Yahweh's anger was kindled against Israel. And in other parts of the literature, poor old Balaam cops it for this. Got to blame somebody. So Yahweh's angry, we'll take that for granted, and then an Israelite has sexual relations with a Midianite. They can't help themselves. Phinehas, Aaron's grandson, kills them both, catches them in the act and slays them both. The plague stops, because God caused the plague because of what they were doing. Yahweh rewards him by establishing him and his descendants as, quote, a perpetual priesthood. Yahweh instructs Moses to war against the Midianites because of this woman who obviously tempted the nice little Israelite man. Cherchez la femme. Number 26. A census is taken of the Israelites. This is a creation of the priestly school, this bit. A census was taken of those who returned to Judah from exile in Babylon. It's likely that this census in chapter 26, which we're not going to read, is an assurance to the returned exiles that their ancestors had a similar experience when they first entered the promised land. We've done this a few times, and many scholars say that these stories about the journey, that the 40 years journey, are meant to be kind of seeing what their ancestors did right and what their ancestors did wrong as a model for how we're supposed to behave. The primary source of the census that we find in Numbers 26 is in Genesis chapter 46, 8 to 37, which lists the Israelites who came out of Egypt. And you'll find if you read them parallel, there are parallels between those two. The purpose of the census here in Numbers 26 is threefold. It substantiates the fact that, as Yahweh had said, the Exodus generation apart from Caleb and Joshua had died out. So they're all finished. The only two alive are Joshua and Caleb. All the rest have died because the 40 years is over. It musters the clans with a view to their conquest and settlement of Canaan, and it provides a basis for the allotment of land in the tribal areas. Though, keep in mind, the tribal areas were always there, the people were always there, they didn't come in from Egypt. If they became Yahwist, it was through a conversion process mostly, and it was only, like most conversions, half-hearted anyhow. So it wasn't an intruding people wiping everybody out and taking over. But that's not what the story of the Bible, as it puts it. Numbers 27 is a story about the daughters of Zelophehad. Interesting story if you're a biblical scholar, because it functions as legitimating the claim of some clans of Manasseh to the legal possession of lands in Canaan over and above their territory in the Transjordan. If you look at the map of the tribal areas, Manasseh is a tribe that stretches on both sides of the Jordan River. So here they are, here in the Transjordan, the east of the Jordan. Now, why are they in just north of Ephraim? Why are they in the Samaritan area? Well, this guarantees this is why they were there, and it tells the story of why they were there. I think it's undoubted that they started there and swept across that way, but that's not the way the story is told. So there's a break from tradition here. Daughters are allowed to inherit as long as the daughter marries within her kinship group. And that's a pretty late development, really, there by the time Numbers is written. So they have to incorporate it as God's will through Moses in the foundation of their nation. But it's actually quite a much later development. You all know about the suffragettes, don't you? So, usually these things come late. Numbers 27, 12 and the following, Yahweh repeats again that Moses cannot enter the promised land. Why? Because of his failure to believe in Yahweh at the waters of Meribah. Remember, he struck the rock twice, according to the Numbers story. It's a different one in Deuteronomy. Moses asks Yahweh to appoint someone, quote, who will go out before them and come in before them, who shall lead them out and bring them in, so that the congregation of Yahweh may not be like sheep without a shepherd. Remember that phrase? Jesus had compassion on them because they're like sheep without a shepherd. It's not accidental. This is the language, like Shakespeare is our language, or the Bible is our language too. So the imagery of the New Testament is constantly drawing on this literature, because it's the only literature they had. This is their language. So there it is, a nice little one there. Yahweh tells Moses to join with Joshua before Eleazar the priest and, quote from chapter 27, commission him in the sight of the congregation. Eleazar laid his hands on him, still the practice in our communities, and commissioned him as Yahweh had directed through Moses. Then in chapter 28 to 29, the priest authors of Numbers bring together and sometimes update various pieces of cult regulation found in Deuteronomy, Exodus, and Leviticus. I suggested to you, and it is only a suggestion, the best I can offer in the light of scholarship, is that Numbers is precisely that. It's a later updating of the more ancient material. And that's why you can consider it post-exilic, but even quite post-exilic. So it's updating certain things. The most significant factor in the adapting of the cult was, in fact, the reform of Josiah, Josiah was king just before the destruction of, or the capture of Jerusalem, 640 to 609. Public cult was limited to the Jerusalem temple by Josiah. Now, that was only possible when there was only Judah, because the rest have all been wiped out, so that made it possible. But they didn't have any local sites. They were trying to purify the religion, one aspect. Another aspect could be that they were trying to build Canberra and get all the taxes to come to the capital city. Is that what happens to them? No. You know what I mean? So they're setting up the temple, it might have a money factor to it as well. The legislation here in Numbers reveals practice in the post-exilic second temple, not way back before the entry into the promised land. So what do they talk about here? And I'll just give you the headings. Daily and morning and evening offering, which was the practice at the time that Numbers was written and is retrojected back here into Moses and Jesus, God rather, talking to Moses about it. Then there's the public sacrifice on the Sabbath. There's new moon sacrifices. There's various spring festivals. And there are three of them: the Paschal festival, the pilgrimage festival of the unleavened bread, the offering of the first fruits, in the autumn, etc. Then there are autumn festivals, the new moon on the seventh month, the offering of the Day of Atonement, the offerings of the autumn pilgrimage festival, 7-day festival of booths at the end of the harvest, and a special offering on the eighth day of the festival. They're all described in those verses of chapter 29. You can read them as easily as I can. I've got no comment on them, except that that's where they're putting them all in and updating all those pieces of cultic legislation. Chapter 30. This legislation covers vows, oaths, and pledges, that is, binding contracts. It's appended here because of the custom of making such pronouncements on the occasion of a pilgrimage to the sanctuary. Now, a vow, there's the Hebrew, neder, is a promise made to God that's conditional on God granting a request. If you heal my daughter, I will. That's a vow. When and if the request is granted, the person making the vow is obliged to do what he or she has promised. That's as understood in the book of Numbers. That makes sense, I'm sure. An oath, sebu'a, calls on God to guarantee the truth of what a person states that he or she will do or not do. It's not conditional. It's binding from the moment it's offered. So I say, I will do this. And I call on God to witness to it. Well, I've got to do it. It's not dependent on anything God does. I've just taken this oath in God's name. And they're described in this chapter 30. Chapter 31. Yahweh instructs Moses to make war against the Midianites. They killed every male. That's supposed to be good. Then they were ordered to kill every woman. However, got to be reasonable, they were able to keep the young unmarried girls for themselves. So that's God's very understanding of the needs that human beings have, the male human being has. And this is written by males. So you're following all at all? I hope you can see you've got to read this with your brain as well as everything else. So then there are two problems. The first concerns history. As with much of the narrative material in the Torah, this seems to be a reading back into the wilderness period of military conflict between Israel and Arab tribes of North Arabia and the Transjordan from a later period. Judges 6 to 8 has something to say about that. Conflict which became part of the epic tradition. But here it's put right back before they entered the Promised Land. 2-3 centuries earlier than the conflict actually happened. Referring to the rivalry between Midian and Israel, referring to the rivalry as one that has been present from the beginning, helped to justify later Israelite aggression. Of course we can fight the Midianites because God told Moses to do it way back there before we entered the Promised Land. So that's, if you need a better reason than that, find it. This brings us then to a more serious problem when we read this text. For the authors not only link the Israel-Arab rivalry with Moses, but they give it divine authorization as well. Now that shouldn't surprise you because some of the settlers in Israel are doing exactly that today. So we're into a very dangerous, when God is brought in to support an ideology of any kind, you're in a dangerous area, clearly. And the Bible is full of it, so we've got to read it with great care. Numbers 32, there's a map there for you, of the Jordan River, that you can see the Lake of Galilee and then the Dead Sea there. You see where Edom is down here, Moab, Ammon, and Bashan is up there, Gilead, Manasseh, Gad, Reuben, the different tribes. That's the map for you to now the what text. The chapter is part of a long history of concern about the legitimacy of Israelites living in the Transjordan, because it's not the Promised Land, not technically, though it's open to it. It seems to have been a particular concern of the priestly writers, possibly because of the disjunction between the Israelites in the area and the temple in post-exilic Judah. Maybe that's what's underlying this. When Judah's a little satrapy of part of the Persian Empire on the, obviously, the west of the Jordan River, but you've still got Israelites out there. How do they fit in? How legitimate are they? You know, what's their author, you know, what's their... The bulk of the chapter 32 refers to the tribes of Reuben and Gad, in the area conquered from the Amorites. That's what the chapter's about, and I don't intend reading it to you because it's, you can read it easily and I've got no comment on it, really. Chapter 33, verses 1 to 49, is a summary of the itinerary of the wilderness wanderings, which we've done already, and you don't need to read the summary now. Chapter 33, verses 50 to 56, Yahweh commands them to, quote, drive out all the inhabitants of the land. and from before you destroy all their figured stones, destroy all their cast images, and demolish all their high places. If they don't, the text goes on to say, Yahweh will treat the Israelites as he is treating the Canaanites. So you've got an ideology here to not get mixed up with other nations, because you'll dilute your religion. So remain ethnically pure is the point of it all. And that becomes an instruction from Yahweh to kill everybody in the land so that you don't mix with them. Can't you hear Jesus say, it was said to you of old, hate your enemies, but I say love your enemies. And if you can't see a distinction between those two, if you can hold both those in your head at the same time, I don't know what you've got for a head, because they're clearly very, very different views. Numbers 34 are the boundaries of the promised land, with a little postscript on the Transjordan, because it's always a bit of a problematic area. And it was probably inhabited later in the 9th century, not this time. Numbers 35 verses 1 to 8 specifies towns from the, and their surrounding pasture lands which are to be allotted to the Levites, because by the time this is Numbers is written, the Levites are not priests. All the Levites were priests originally, but this group has been demoted and the priests are the special group. We talked about them last week, and the Levites have their special job to put salt on the sacrifices and wine and prepare things, but the priest alone could offer them and so on. So they've got to be supported because they don't have any land. So they've got to get some kind of way of surviving. Numbers 35, 9 to 34 specifies towns that are to be set up as places of refuge for a person who kills another person unintentionally. That's because, we've done it earlier, but just remind you, the Goel is the redeemer. That's the word redeemer meaning. So, you kill my brother in a fight somewhere. I am obliged by every tribal instinct in me and in everybody else. I must revenge that death. You can't let it go. I've got to find you or someone in your tribe and kill them. Otherwise, for heaven's sake, you'll tread all over us. You get it? So that's stuff. That's in the Greek world as well, and the Roman world is a very common thing. This, and if you don't, you lack virtue and lack courage. You've got to be a man and you've got to do it. So that's the system. So you kill my brother in a brawl. Doesn't matter whether he's you're responsible. I'm going to kill you. So if it was unintentional, if it was an accident, you've got to rush off somewhere and get protection, because I'm after you. And my brother is too, and my uncle. Everybody around, you don't know who the hell's after you. So you've got to, so they set up little places where they could go for this, which gave time for some kind of court process to check and realise that it was unintentional. In fact, you didn't even kill him at all. The rafter of the roof fell in and hit him. It wasn't this bloke at all, so then you have, then you're allowed off. You don't have to revenge because it's not your responsibility anymore. Then there's a little instruction to make sure, we did a bit of that story, women who inherit must marry within their kinship group. Because what was happening is the women would marry outside their kinship group, and then we, people from Naphtali, would lose land to the people from somewhere else. So we had to hold on to our land. So the woman could only inherit if she married someone of us. That's come in to protect inheritance and so on. Then the abrupt ending of the book of Numbers, which it ends abruptly, just look at it, is another indication of the supplementary nature of this catch-up literature. Because it just ends nowhere. It just ends. And that's probably another indication that we're dealing with a late additional bringing together of the literature.